Mudley.
Bring us on from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
On January 3, 2020, former U.S. President Donald Trump directly ordered drone strikes that killed Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the deputy commander of Iraq's Hashd al-Shaabi anti-terror force. 5 days later, Operation Qasem Soleimani. Iran retaliated by firing dozens of missiles at Ain al-Assad Air Base in al-Anbar Governorate, western Iraq, as well as another U.S. air base in Erbil, declaring that the attacks were part of his promised tough revenge for the assassination. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look back at that day, Iran's bold and courageous move, and how Iran's revenge from the U.S. is not over. First, let me introduce our guests. Sadam Mutalabi, Iraqi politician, joins us from Baghdad. Also joining us is Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'll first start with you, Sadam Mutalabi. Obviously, you're familiar with this incident, and it's the third anniversary of this ballistic missile attack against the Ain al-Assad air base. But tell us what you thought when that happened. What went through your mind?
Yes, thank you very much. Well, we were expecting. Everybody were expecting retaliation, a hard retaliation by the Islamic Republic of Iran, and I think the Americans also. From the information we gathered that the Americans knew or were expecting such an attack on their bases, therefore they, to minimize their casualties, they would not congregate in one area, they were spread around the camp, and they've actually dug new trenches where they were sleeping the night, as they have explained after the attack. And so we were all expecting the attack, but I was very surprised at the severity of the attack. We did not expect that amount of missiles and the accuracy of the missiles that were used were definitely a surprise to us and naturally to the Americans, who were the target of the strikes. We felt that it is a sign, or it is a first step. But I'm sure, as you very well know and everybody know, this will not compensate for the martyrdom of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and, of course, General Soleimani. But as you know and we accept that if we are murdered by the Westerner forces, the non-believers, this is automatically a martyrdom. So there's no regret on that. Uh-huh. But the regret is that we have not yet managed to gain the vengeance, or at least to see justice served to those who were responsible for this atrocity against, sure, our leaders. But As you said, as you asked, yes, that was we were expecting. But of course, it was a big surprise, the amount and the accuracy of those missiles.
We're going to talk about those missiles a little later down in the program. But Zafar Bangash, you know, when you have this predicament that Iran faced after, obviously, the assassination of Qasem Soleimani and Mahdi Amandis, there are lots of options that I'm sure that was on the table. Of course, what I'm asking you is perhaps kind of tough to maybe respond to. But given the variety of options that Iran had decide on, what do you think about the option that it finally rested on and then executed, and, of course, the result that it had?
Well, first of all, before I address that question, I would like to put this whole issue into its proper legal context. The attack that Trump had ordered for the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and his comrade Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis, it was a war crime. In fact, at that time, the UN Special Rapporteur for Extrajudicial Killings, Agnes Callamard, in her report submitted to the Security Council in July of 2020, she clearly stated that it was a war crime, that General Qasem Soleimani was a senior official, he was on a diplomatic mission, and therefore this constituted a war crime. I also want to remind your viewers that according to Chapter 7, Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, it clearly states that if a member of the United Nations is subjected to aggression, illegal aggression, as this was from the United States, then the victim party has the right to carry out retaliation in whatever way it deems necessary. So we need to keep these two points in mind and then look at the response of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which obviously was within its right and within its power to carry out that missile strike at the two military bases, in particular an al-Assad military base in Anbar province. And what is absolutely incredible is that this was the first time in contemporary history that any country has been able to carry out such a retaliatory strike against the United States. If we look at the situation, for instance, in Ukraine today, the U.S. is supplying all kinds of weapons to Ukraine. In fact, missiles that the Ukrainians are using against military bases in Russia. And although Russia has warned that it is going to retaliate against the United States, but it has not done so, although Russia is supposed to be a superpower. So in fact, what the Islamic Republic of Iran did was to break that psychological barrier in hitting the United States forces and hitting them hard. But as your guest pointed out, that's not the final thing. There's going to be other retaliations coming through. And of course, we can talk about it as we proceed in the program. But definitely, this was a major, major psychological breakthrough that the Islamic Republic of Iran achieved, and therefore set an example for other countries that they can take retaliatory action against this rogue regime that is the United States.
You know, when that happened, when this attack did take place, Saddam al-Talabi, there was somewhat of an underestimation that also took place. Because initially, if you remember, the U.S., the former U.S. President Donald Trump came out and said it was no big deal. We didn't suffer anything. It was just maybe some minor injuries that happened. And somewhat of a symbolic act is the type of impression that he was trying to give off. But obviously, there was a lot more to it. Let's talk about the missiles, which obviously the Americans knew that Iranians had, but they underestimated the power, because looking at the facts, it was the largest missile attack. But in terms of the missile firepower, upwards of 1,100 pounds of high explosive were these missiles in terms of their capability, and of which this U.S. base or any U.S. base cannot withstand a direct hit from these missiles, the name Fateh 313. So how was it that that was something that the U.S. underestimated, given Iran's power in its missile capability?
I think the United States underestimated Iran's power in many issues, not only the missiles. And the biggest underestimation was with the accuracy. To make big bombs, that's easy. You know, you make a big tube and you put a lot of TNT in it, and that's it. But to make it accurate, that is the hard part. And to make it fly for hundreds, or thousands, I don't know, hundreds of kilometers to a target which is the size of a blanket and hit that blanket from so many hundreds of kilometers away, that requires an extreme accuracy. And that was definitely showed by this attack. And they weren't concentrating in one area, they were concentrating on all over the camp, the Ayn al-Assad, which in the end resulted to the almost total destruction of the camp. And so the amount of power these missiles had was incredible. And it's obvious that the Americans did not want to escalate further. Because as you very correctly said, Mr. Trump, the president, came out and underestimated the whole event. And as if it was like, children throwing stones or something like that. Because he knew that his forces were not able in defending themselves against the Islamic Republic by the numbers and the forces they had in the region. And they would definitely suffer further destruction if they were to re-escalate the issue.
Yes, Zafar Bangash, you mentioned how this has never happened before. I'm going to take a direct quote from the then Army Major Robert Hayes, who was the top doctor at Ayn al-Assad, who said, quote, "It has never happened in history that a ground force has been exposed to 11 theater ballistic missiles." And to further add to that, just a couple of testimonials, two U.S. officers, they said that the strikes caused the shelter's doors to bend like waves. And another saying that the old videos of Hiroshima, where the bright light came after it exploded and the cloud and the brightness showed itself, are just a couple of the testimonials here. Now, I'm not trying to promote the use of the missile, but the Iran's missile capability and the effect that it had, which to what statement that you made, it kind of breaks that invincibility that the U.S. Army perhaps has with this attack. What then can come out of that when the invincibility has been broken, of in this case, the Islamic Republic, making the courageous decision to attack the U.S. military base?
Well, to reiterate once again, the accuracy of the missiles of the Islamic Republic, I mean, it was actually pinpoint accuracy. The entire infrastructure, the barracks and the bases, etc., at Ayn al-Assad were totally obliterated. And this is a remarkable achievement by the Islamic Republic of Iran. In addition to that, as you pointed out, initially, Donald Trump tried to sort of downplay the impact of this strike by saying, well, we didn't suffer any casualties, etc. But later on, it emerged that there were at least 100 American forces that were moved to hospitals in Kuwait who were receiving, they had suffered serious concussions, serious trauma, and they were receiving treatment in Kuwaiti hospitals. This was even admitted by an American general by the name of General Shaw, Major General Shaw, who said that our American forces did suffer those casualties. So first of all, it was the pinpoint accuracy of Iran's missiles. Secondly, the blows that were inflicted on the Americans. And third, that psychological barrier that has been broken because America got a message that the Islamic Republic of Iran is capable and willing to be able to take action against any aggression that is imposed against the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we saw that, after that, Trump basically in downplaying the significance of this retaliation, clearly did not want to escalate the situation because he knew that the American forces are going to suffer massive casualties if Trump attempted to do that. So in that sense, I think it is a very important breakthrough in terms of contemporary warfare. And it shows that the Islamic Republic of Iran is not only capable, but it has a leadership that is courageous and is prepared to stand up for its rights and not be bullied into submissions, as so many other countries, unfortunately, have been done. So I think this is a new paradigm. It's a paradigm shift, actually, in modern warfare. And we see now that America is gradually moving out of the region, which, of course, should be the ultimate objective of the Islamic Republic of Iran, as well as all other forces that are fighting against foreign interference, foreign aggression. So I think that process has already started, and it started with, in fact, Iran's courageous stand against the aggression that America had perpetrated. And obviously, this is not the end of it. It needs to continue in different ways, but I'm sure that the Islamic Republic decision makers will determine that as to when the, what the appropriate time is and what is the best way to do that.
Indeed. Let's take a look at now the impact that this has had in terms of the U.S. calculations. Saddam al-Talabi. So we're looking at this Ain al-Assad base, which is a huge base from what we understand. I mean, it takes about half hour to go from one end to the other. And you have this attack that's taken place. And then you have, as our guest there, Zafar Bangash, mentioned, and I'm sure you're well aware, that up to 100 U.S. soldiers suffered some major injuries, basically head traumas, concussions, etc. And also the fact that these U.S. soldiers, they weren't even safe when they went and hid in the bunker, which shows the vulnerability of the base when it comes to these missiles. So my question then is, doesn't that cause then a major shift to at a minimum, but rather it puts the U.S. in a dilemma? If their base cannot be safe from a missile attack, and in this case from Iran, then they have to change their calculations. How do you think that impacted their view militarily when it comes to a U.S. base, and in this case in Iraq and maybe in other parts of West Asia?
Yeah, that's why they spent billions and billions of dollars on finding new ways in combating or trying to stop missiles and intercepting flying missiles into their bases. And since 2020, as I said, billions and billions of dollars were poured into technological companies in trying to find workable methods to stop missiles falling on them. But regardless of that, is the actual event, the actual act of attacking these missiles, which created this ripple effect that people previously, we all thought that the Americans would be invincible and their bases, nobody would be able to get close to their bases. And even if they did, maybe with a small, you know, small artillery or indirect fire, like mortars or something like that. But to have this amount of accurate missiles falling on the base, that was definitely a large surprise and a shock to the Americans and to the world. That showed the amount of power that the Islamic Republic can wield at will and can deliver with tremendous accuracy into the American bases. The Americans definitely are taking a less aggressive role now in Iraq and taking a back seat in events. They do move diplomatically, politically, but as the presence of their military forces, we see very, very little amount of movement militarily, air support or ground support. We don't see any American presence now. A few years since that event, I personally haven't seen any American soldier in Iraq since that incident. So the Americans have definitely diverted their attention in Iraq more away from military intervention into a diplomatic effort, and that is possibly a positive outcome. But still, you know, the Americans, their diplomacy is not easy. We definitely need to know that their interference could be very negative in events here in Iraq.
Zafar Bangash, the U.S. calculations and their approach and military strategy, obviously it stems from their maneuverability when it comes to their bases. When their bases are fragile, in this case, in point again, because of these missiles, it has to have an impact as to how they are going to approach any militaristic adventurism that they may have, whether it's inside of Iraq or in other countries in the region. Do you think that had an impact on that?
Oh, absolutely. It had a tremendous impact because if we look at it, and to reiterate, number one, the Americans did not, escalate this issue. They had to back down by downplaying the significance of the Iranian missile retaliatory strike, because they knew that if they escalated this, that they are going to suffer, number one. Secondly, and I would like to link this with the American defeat in Afghanistan as well, which occurred, of course, about a year and a half that they had to run away from Afghanistan. And despite the fact that America claims to be a superpower, it has, and there is no doubt that it has enormous destructive power at its disposal, that it has a lot of weapons, etc., that it can cause a lot of damage in the country. And yet it was forced to flee from Afghanistan because it saw that despite all of its weapons, it is not able to subdue the people over there. And this was a development in the entire region. In fact, if you look at some of the Arab regimes immediately after Iran's strikes on these two American military bases, both Qatar and the UAE sent their, representative. The UAE sent its foreign minister to Iran to tell them that, as far as UAE is concerned, it is not involved in it and it doesn't want to, escalate this. It had nothing to do with it. And similarly with the Qataris, they sent their representatives to tell the Islamic Republic of Iran that they had nothing to do with the American strikes and they would like to keep out of it. So this had a tremendous ripple effect in the entire region. And I think this needs to spread further in order to drive America's intrusive actions in that region. These are destabilizing. These are not in the interests of the people. And once the Americans are driven out of the region completely, then I think it would be possible for the Muslims to deal with that other illegitimate entity, the Zionist regime. So we look forward to that day when that would happen.
Okay. Now let's talk about Iraq a little bit. And Saad Motalebi, who better than to ask you this question? I mean, when you take a look at Iraq, what happened with Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mohandas in terms of the assassination that took place, the U.S. Made a decision to do that in Iraqi soil. And so many times Iran has mentioned the destabilizing, impact that the U.S. has by its presence in Iraq. But Iraq's sovereignty, its territorial integrity, was violated by the decision that the U.S. made. And hence Iran, and I believe Iran did inform the Iraqi government, went ahead and took the decision to do what it did in terms of attacking Ain al-Assad in the way that it did. But Iraq's sovereignty was first violated by the U.S. Didn't that lead to Iraqi politicians, lawmakers, and the government to then really go ahead and want U.S. to leave their country?
Oh, definitely, yes. There were a tremendous amount of demonstrations and violence and against the towards the American presence in Baghdad and in Iraq in general, and there were a tremendous amount of pressure. The parliament voted for the immediate removal of all American forces from Iraq, but the government at the time could not, and then Mr. Kademi came, who was probably, I don't know, the investigation is still going on. He could be involved in this. He could, maybe he's not. I don't know. We are waiting for the evidence to be declared. But the people feeling in general was, the anger was absolutely tremendous. And the people were, and the parliament and all government organizations, they were calling for the Americans to leave the country immediately. But of course, you know, the amount of pressure that was exerted of the at that time the government. I mean, I remember the prime minister at the time, Abdel Mahdi. He came to the parliament and asked the parliament, please vote to get the Americans out. And the parliament took that brave decision and voted for the removal of the American forces. And the numbers were reduced tremendously. I think 3,000 immediately had to leave the country. And what the remaining forces now is really just administrators and a number of trainers.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Saad al-Mutalabi there from Baghdad, Iraqi politician. Thank you. Zafar Bangash, a pleasure, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وقال الذين كفروا إن هذا إلا إفك افتراه وأعانه عليه قوم آخرون فقد
Those who disbelieve say, this Quran is not except a falsehood he invented, and another people assisted him in it. But they have committed an injustice and a lie.
Brothers and sisters, we are now going to discuss the fourth verse of chapter Furqan. The fourth verse starts saying, وَقَالَ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا إِنْ هَذَا إِلَّا إِفْكٌ افْتَرَاهُ And those who disbelieve say, This Qur'an is nothing but a lie, which he
has forged. وَأَعَانَهُ عَلَيْهِ قَوْمٌ آخَرُونَ And other people have helped him at it. فَقَدْ جَاءُوا ظُلْمًا وَزُورًا So indeed, they have done injustice and uttered a falsehood. So this noble verse is about the pagans' analysis, or in better terms, their pretext-seeking against the call of the Prophet ﷺ when it says, وَقَالَ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا إِنْ هَذَا إِفْكٌ افْتَرَاهُ And those who disbelieve say, this Qur'an is nothing but a lie which he, the apostle, has forged. And they say that he was not alone in this. وَأَعَانَهُ عَلَيْهِ قَوْمٌ آخَرُونَ Other people have helped him at it. So, in fact, in order not to shoulder the truth, as those who in the course of history decided to be against divine leaders, they first accused him to falsehood. They accused the Prophet to calumny, and specially, in order to scorn the Holy Qur'an, they used the word هذا, or this. This means that they wanted to scorn the Holy Qur'an, they wanted to suggest that this is not an important thing, so they referred to it with هذا, or this. And then, in order to prove that he could not say such words by himself, because saying such meaningful words, of course, needs at least a lot of knowledge, and they did not want to accept it. So, in order to say that this was a calculated program, they decided to say that he was not alone, and others have helped him at it, and that there was a conspiracy, and they must stand against him because he has been having the help of the others in forging these lies through this Qur'an. And overall, إِنْ هَذَا إِلَّا إِفْكٌ افْتَرَاهُ they said. This Qur'an is nothing but a lie which he has forged, and nothing else. There is no value in that. على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Some of the commentators have said that the purpose of the term قَوْمٌ آخَرُونَ, other people, is a group of Jews. Some others, however, have said that the objective is three persons of the people of the book. But what matters is that since such matters did not exist among the polytheists of Mecca and some parts of it, such as the story of former prophets and the story of some of the people of the book, they had to drag the people of the book into this accusation
so that the people became less astonished and bewildered by hearing these verses. So how evil and satanic those thoughts were in trying to scorn the Holy Quran, in trying to accusing the Prophet to falsehood and calumny. And it seems that throughout the history, this has been the best way that the polytheists, the unbelievers, the evildoers of the history have taken as their approach towards the righteous people. They always try to say that these people are forging lies and you should not believe them. They're just the usual normal people among us. And in this case, since he had brought something new, something valuable to their world, which was called the Quran, they couldn't believe that he himself had brought it to them. So they, under the pretext of being helped by the others, try to tell the other people of the society that he is forging lie. But this lie was with the help of the others, and that is why sometimes you may be astonished. But the Holy Quran tries to answer them in only one term. فَقَدْ جَاءُوا ظُلْمًا وَزُورًا. We will, God willing, talk about this verse later on. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets, this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The two-year anniversary of the election integrity protest, which burst into Congress on January 6, 2020, has been overshadowed by Congress's historic failure to select the third most important post in the country, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. After more than a dozen votes, mainstream Republican Kevin McCarthy finally won a majority, ending the total paralysis of the new Congress. However, the embarrassing stalemate was the worst of its kind since before the American Civil War.
Both of them just show how American politics is dominated by spectacle and political theater, while Americans who are suffering through terrible economic hardship right now and are politically polarized are just sitting on the sidelines while all this plays out.
As the speaker chaos continued, Democrats demanded attention for 2020, while Republican lawmakers largely ignored the anniversary. The stark difference isn't surprising. Polls have long shown that 35% of the country still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% still calls it an insurrection. The subsequent January 6th committee to investigate the incident was either branded a political show trial and witch hunt or a necessary defense of American-style democracy.
It should have been a bipartisan inquiry, a serious one, into what was, you know, supposedly this, you know, vast constitutional violation by Trump and his campaign and his administration. And it's just become this endless commercial for the Democratic Party, which is totally bankrupt. And 2 years later, they're still using it to, you know, try and get themselves elected.
While Washington is repeatedly faulted for encouraging protests in other countries, almost 200 January 6th protesters have been sentenced to prison terms. Seemingly every participant has been publicly hunted down, which may serve as a chilling effect which forestalls future protests. Has Washington's response to the controversial events of January 6, 2020 reduced conflict, division, and disunity? We cannot ask Congress, because just like 2 years ago, they cannot meet in peace. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
It's afternoon, and many Rohingya women are waiting in a queue to receive blankets offered by an NGO. Some are angry since they haven't received any blankets yet. Over the last few days, northern India has had freezing weather, and that has heaped misery of homelessness for the refugees living in makeshift tents. Zahid Hussain has come out of his shanty to have some sunlight. He says he's worried as his child has developed a skin disease that's getting worse and worse. He asked me to come to his shanty, where he is living with his family in appalling conditions.
My child is very sick. He got some skin disease. God knows what it is. But doctors say it's chickenpox or measles. He is very irritated due to uneasiness of skin. The day starts with his sickness, and all day long it's silently killing him with fevers and chills. Once a doctor from some NGO came here and gave medicine, but nothing worked.
Activists say such treatment of the community is against the Indian ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which translates to the world is one family. In recent years, a vicious expulsion campaign has shed more light on the way India treats specific communities. Rights activists have been urging the government to adopt a uniform refugee policy which treats refugees equally, regardless of their faith or ethnicity. Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are braving the cold weather and live in makeshift tents across the Indian subcontinent. These people, who always face the threat of detention and deportation, are here struggling for survival.
In this camp, children are getting sick and the sickness is unusual. They are getting chills, vomiting and fever. We have never seen this skin disease before. Even after visiting the doctor, the children are not getting any better. In every family, you will find children with this sickness. Now even women and men are getting affected. It's a very dangerous situation. Some say the sickness is spread to other camps. Doctors have advised us not to have guests from other camps and not to visit them.
Many refugees I spoke with shared heart-wrenching stories with me, and most of them kept asking why their voice is not being heard in the age of technology. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports suggest the real figure stands at hundreds of thousands. Rohingya Muslims are being treated as illegal immigrants in India and elsewhere after fleeing Myanmar. Activists in India have stressed the urgent need to protect the Rohingyas' rights as refugees. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The inflation rate in Italy has been high for a while, breaking record after record. An increasing number of Italians are struggling to make ends meet, fearing that the cost of living pinch could soon turn into pain. The National Bureau of Statistics recently announced that the prices in the country rose more than 8% year on year in 2022, jumping to its highest 12-month gain in 37 years.
It is impossible to continue this way. Gas and electricity bills have more than doubled, and the cost of bread and milk is going mad. This is pure madness.
Italy's annual inflation rate in December dropped to 11.6%, down from 11.8% in November, but the cost of living crisis keeps biting businesses and households hard. High energy prices caused by energy supply challenges that followed the Ukraine-Russia war is the main factor contributing to this surge.
The immediate loss of this situation has been the collapse of purchasing power by over 10%, which translates to the net loss of one monthly payment for employed workers. People on low-income wages, such as employees and workmen, which represents 90% of the labour force, are among those suffering the most.
Analysts believe that a combination of high inflation, rising interest rates, and a lack of fiscal support will push Italy and other EU economies into recession.
You miss it, well.
Month after month, life is becoming increasingly tough. My retirement payment went up 50 euros 2 months ago, but the cost of living has increased by 200 euros each month.
Life is more expensive for those who live on one income only. The cost of renting houses, buying clothes for our kids, food. I can't see how we'll be able to face all this.
With the aim to fight high inflation and put prices under control, the European Central Bank has raised interest rates. The move is likely to hamper the European economy further. Some ministers in the Italian government have strongly criticized the ECB over its aggressive monetary policy that they believe could raise the prospect of recession. Max Civili, Rome.
A mass rally has been staged in the Yemeni capital along with several other Yemeni provinces called Al-Hisar Harb Alayna, which translates to, "The siege is war upon us." Yemen is experiencing one of the worst humanitarian crises in history due to what protesters call the U.S. and Saudi Arabia strangling blockade on innocent civilians. Demonstrators called for an immediate end to the blockade and the ongoing war.
We came out in this blessed protest to tell the aggressors and their allies that their blockade is a war on us. Therefore, we, the Yemeni people, say if you do not lift your blockade, we will certainly teach you a lesson you will never forget. We will not sit back and watch our people starve to death.
We came out to deliver a message to the world that we will no longer remain silent on this aggression, war, and blockade on our people.
Yemen's military spokesperson reiterated this week that if the Saudi-led coalition fails to lift the blockade, the Yemeni army will have no choice but to use military force to break the siege. Protesters in Sana'a expressed that it's time to use the military card, since the Saudi-led coalition continues to seize Yemeni fuel ships in the Red Sea.
We came out today to tell our military forces to go ahead and strike the capital cities of our enemies so they can be forced to leave the blockade by the will of Allah. Only then they will live in disgrace and humility.
The protest comes after a week of violence stemming from the continuous Saudi shelling in the northern province of Sada, which has killed and injured dozens of civilians over the past 2 weeks. Furthermore, Saudi Arabia continues to seize and detain Yemeni fuel ships in the Red Sea, preventing them from reaching the port of Hodeidah and unloading the much-needed fuel supply.
The Saudi-led coalition attacked Yemen in 2015, declaring they would defeat the Ansar Allah movement and their allies within a matter of weeks. It is now 2023, and they have not achieved any of their goals. This, as the Yemeni government based in Sana'a continues to advance its military deterrence capabilities. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
St. Pancras Station, one of London's biggest and busiest. But not today.
A 48-hour strike by train drivers, preceded by another 48-hour walkout by other rail workers, have meant travel misery for thousands. The dispute between ASLEF and the RMT Rail Workers Union on the one hand, and the employer Network Rail and train operating companies on the other, is largely over pay and the impact of inflation on workers' wages. But disagreements have kept a deal elusive for months.
Well, we want to hear movement on the issue about some of the conditions they've put down in Network Rail. That's a restructuring of all our members' terms and conditions. And it's a similar recipe in the train operating companies. They've gone for a thing called driver-only operation, which we think is extremely unhelpful. We can't accept that. And, of course, we'd like an improvement in the pay offers.
Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has so far refused to meet with the unions to try and hammer out a deal and has instead vowed to get tough on the strikes. His government is also accused of trying to turn public opinion against the strikers. But there's no sign of that happening yet.
I think workers are well within their rights to demand at least living wages to be kept in line with inflation. So, yeah, I'm fully supportive of this.
I really sympathise. I think they're right. So I'm not mad. It's inconvenient.
The UK economy is experiencing the combined effects of Brexit, the war in Ukraine, and its effect on energy costs, as well as inflationary pressure on the post-pandemic recovery. And rail workers are not the only ones complaining.
ASLEF and the RMT are two of the UK's most powerful unions, able to bring their railway service to a standstill during industrial disputes. And the concerns they have been raising about the difference between people's pay packets and the cost of living at the moment are shared by many different industries and professions.
Nurses, ambulance drivers, teachers, postal workers, driving examiners and the like all have pay deals with the government in the pipelines and are likely to be offered less than the rate of inflation. And that means the UK's winter of discontent is likely to drag on. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Veteran Iranian politicians were present alongside foreign activists, scholars, and researchers on the second and final day of the first international conference on Martyr Soleimani's School of Thought. Panel discussions shed light on different dimensions of Martyr Soleimani's life and legacy.
You have to live with people like Martyr Soleimani to understand why they chose that certain lifestyle. Not only that, but even more important is how they choose to die. This makes people like Martyr Soleimani stand out.
According to the participants of the conference, Martyr Soleimani had a deep understanding of politics and based his views on the guidelines of the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. They say this is the most important reason why he should always be remembered.
It is our national duty to keep the memory of Martyr Soleimani alive. He is a role model for future generations, and we need to elaborate on his school of thought for the next generation to walk down the same path.
My husband is in prison in our country, the Republic of Azerbaijan, since 2011, when he was sentenced to 12 years in prison for protesting against the ban on hijab. He was inspired by Martyr Soleimani. It is very important to introduce Martyr Soleimani to the world and the younger generation.
The plight of the Palestinians was another topic high on the agenda.
This conference is of great importance because one of the major goals of Martyr Soleimani was to liberate Palestine, and this is also one of the major issues that was pointed out in the panel discussion. It has also been mentioned in the final statement of the conference.
Eight panels separately focused on different dimensions of Martyr Soleimani's school of thought, from his personal life to his teachings and great leadership skills. However, his views regarding international politics received more attention.
I think we can highlight three points. One deals with the role that General Soleimani had in stopping U.S. hegemonic designs for the Middle East. The second point was his ability to organize people, create networks of like-minded people. So he was a religious man, he was an ethical man, he was someone that attracted people, and that was one of the reasons that he was successful.
While the organizers of the conference have decided to set up a permanent secretariat, they say they are open to receiving more research papers, projects, and books for the next conference, which will be focusing more on the legacy of a man who is known for making great efforts in eradicating insecurity in the region. Lieutenant General Qassem Soleimani fought for peace, security, and stability in the region. According to the participants of this conference, his greatest legacy and achievement was eliminating Daesh terrorists. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
While the world celebrates the start of a new year with festivities and a display of fireworks, Yemen ushers in the new year with fireworks from artillery shelling by the Saudi-led coalition. In just the first hours of 2023, Saudi Arabia carried out a series of artillery shelling in northern Yemen close to Saudi borders. According to the reports, at least 18 innocents were injured in the latest attacks. This comes after a year of bloodshed, according to the Humanity Eye Center for Rights and Development. In their latest report for the year 2022, the center revealed statistics of war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition. According to the report, over 3,000 Yemenis were killed and injured in 2022. Humanity Eye Center statistic and research analyst Gais Jamal reports that these crimes occurred near the Saudi border during a ceasefire.
In the year 2022, most of the crimes were committed on residents living in bordering districts with Saudi Arabia, despite the announcement of a ceasefire. The only thing that stopped was the airstrikes. However, Saudi rockets and artillery shelling continued. There was no ceasefire in the districts near the Saudi border. From the first day the ceasefire was announced, the attacks continued until this day.
Saudi Arabia and its coalition also attacked airports, Yemeni ports, and almost 15,000 homes, livestock farms, and communication stations in 2020, according to the report. Humanity Eye says it has all the evidence to prove that Saudi-led coalition committed war crimes on a mass scale.
We have met with French rights groups and presented to them reports with evidence that expose how Saudi Arabia and its allies and European states played a direct role in supporting Saudi Arabia with weapons that were used to commit war crimes on Yemenis. We presented all necessary evidence to this French rights group, and they have filed a case in court against Mohammed bin Salman and bin Zayed for the war crimes committed. This case is currently pending.
The European legal system is unlikely to bring any Saudi or UAE official to justice, which is why Yemenis want justice now.
We are calling on our government to take tough military actions against the aggressors. They are occupying our lands, destroying our homes, and killing us, and we will not remain silent for much longer. We are a free Yemeni nation with a great civilization. We have the right to defend ourselves.
The Yemeni people are suffering from the blockade and the oppression being spearheaded by Saudi Arabia. Therefore, we call on the Yemeni government to take decisive actions now to lift the blockade and end the suffering of the people.
As the conflict enters a new year, tensions are steadily rising on all active battlefronts in Yemen between Saudi-led forces and the Yemeni army. If a peaceful resolution is not reached soon, an all-out war is likely to ensue.
Pressure is beginning to mount on the Yemeni government to end the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition as millions of Yemenis continue to suffer. Yemenis we spoke with are calling on the Ansarullah movement to end the siege now by any means necessary. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
Allah, 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 Allah. چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Imam Khomeini's viewpoint on condition of leadership. The model of leadership. In the early days of Islam, the ideal Islamic government ruled twice. First, at the time of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his pure progeny. And secondly, when Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, governed.